The material in this podcast is for information purposes only. It does not represent the opinions of Vested Finance and is not intended to be investment advice. We recommend you to consult with a financial advisor before committing to any financial decisions. Hello again, everyone. Welcome to episode 13 of our Vested Finance podcast. My name is Kai Han. I'm an editor at Vested calling in from Singapore. My co-host today is Jarwin, a co-founder at Vested, who is recording from the US. Great having you back again, Jarwin.
Thanks, Kai. Glad to be here. And to our listeners, thanks again for joining us this week. All right, Kai, what are we discussing today?
Well, among other things, it looks like once again we're going to talk about companies going public, one in the US and the other in China and Hong Kong. The first is a company called Affirm, and the other is Ant Group. Some of our listeners know that recently Ant Group failed in its attempt to go public. And honestly, at the time, I thought they had it in the bag. I mean, Ant was going to be the highest valued fintech IPO of all time. What happened?
Well, to understand Ant's failed IPO and Affirm's business, let's take a brief detour and talk about what it means to be a bank. So since its inception in ancient times, banks have operated principally on the same basic framework. Banks have three roles, generally. Role one, banks collect deposits from people, or in other words, you lend the bank money. Role two, the banks then lend these deposits to others and charge interest rates. And then role three, when these borrowers pay back the bank plus interest, the bank gives you some of this interest and pockets the difference. So one way to modulate a bank's profitability is to measure how cheaply it can gain deposits. The cheaper it gets the deposit, the higher the margin it can potentially achieve. Over time, this basic framework has gained additional layers of complexities. The lending business becomes more varied. The amount of deposit the banks have to keep, this is called the reserve requirement, changes over time as governed by the central bank, the Fed. And with increased regulatory complexities, the cost of compliance has started to outpace revenue growth. The level of complexities that banks have to deal with have slowed them down significantly. As a result, the financial services landscape is shifting. New entrants masquerading as e-commerce company, coffee sellers, payment companies, and many others are taking advantage of the same basic framework outlined just now, but without the overhead complexities and regulations that the banks have to endure to gain deposits and lend out money at a lower cost. So in effect, playing the different roles of a bank without being a bank.
Okay, so in your article, you talked about different non-bank companies that generate revenue by doing different roles. Can you explain what you mean?
Right. So the first example is Starbucks. Starbucks makes money by selling you coffee, assortments of food, but it also makes money by taking deposits from its consumers. Starbucks is actually an innovator in digital payments. It came out with its payments app in 2009, just 2 years after the iPhone was launched. Through its mobile payment system, consumers can preload their account with money. If you think about it, the act of preloading cash into your Starbucks wallet is equivalent to lending Starbucks money with zero interest. And Starbucks accumulate these funds, and over time, some portion of these funds is never used, which then becomes revenue for the company. Internally, Starbucks calls this breakage revenue. In Starbucks' fiscal year 2019, consumers deposited almost $11 billion in their wallets. From this, Starbucks made about $140 million from breakage, or 1.28% breakage rate. This is about 8% of their total annual revenue. Talk about finding loose change between the couch cushions.
Let's talk about Affirm, which is going public in the next few weeks. I'm guessing Affirm performs the second role of the bank, which is lending?
Yep, consumer lending specifically. Just to be clear, banks also lend to small, medium businesses, but that has been in decline, especially after the last financial crisis in 08-09. But for the purpose of the article and this podcast, we focus on consumer lending and Affirm.
So tell us, Darwin, what does Affirm do?
Generally, there are several approaches taken by tech companies to give out loans. One approach is providing short-term loans for e-commerce purchases. This is called Buy Now, Pay Later, BNPL model. This is where the company interjects itself in the e-commerce checkout process, offering lower interest rate loans, often 0%, to consumers making purchases. This is what Affirm does. So the BNPL industry is relatively new in the US. In the US, online purchases have been dominated by credit cards, which effectively acts as a buy now, pay later mechanism, where you purchase an item, you pay your credit card bill later, right? BNPL players such as Affirm replace the role of the credit card. So although still very new, the BNPL market share is expanding in North America. It is expected to grow to 3% of e-commerce payments by 2023. Meanwhile, in Europe, Middle East, Africa, BNPL constitutes about 6% of e-commerce payments and is expected to grow to 10% by 2023. So there are these players called Afterpay that originated from Australia and then Klarna in Europe. So here's how Affirm's work. when you, the consumer, purchase an item, let's say the purchase price is $1,000, you check out through Affirm on the e-commerce website, the merchant then delivers the item to you. The merchant does not actually get the money from the user or Affirm, but it gets it from the bank. So if the purchase price of the item is $1,000, the cash that the merchant receives is somewhere less than $1,000. So let's assume that the loan fee is $50, so the merchant gets $950. Affirm then records that the consumer has a loan for $1,000 plus fees and then sends the bank $1,000, the original cost of the item. The bank receives this cash and then pass along the $50 fee as merchant fee back to Affirm. So from this flow, as you can imagine, Affirm actually generates revenue from the fee of the original loan. And ultimately, this fee is paid by the merchant after it passes through the bank. And Affirm also gain on interest rates on the loan from consumers. Now, because Affirm buys the loans back from the bank, the company holds the debt on its balance sheet. Therefore, Affirm must have a good credit risk profiling system to ensure low default rates of the loans it holds, right? And Affirm showed that it does. On its S1, it boasts that the weighted average quarterly delinquency rate is about 1.1% of the 3 years ending in September 2020. It also has this chart, which you can also see on our blog post that accompanies this podcast recording, which we will link on the show notes, that shows that Affirm's risk scoring model actually outperforms the traditional US FICO credit score.
So from what you're saying, it sounds like Affirm's business has three different shareholders?
Yes. So the first is merchants, as we mentioned. In return for paying Affirm fees to generate loans, merchants get higher checkout conversion and higher average spend. The boost is anywhere between 80% to 90% higher average order value. This turns out to be a really powerful effect for the merchant, especially for high-priced items. Stakeholder number two, banks make money when Affirm buys back the loans from the principal plus the accrued interest. And number three, consumers. Consumers get additional purchasing power and the flexibility of paying back the purchase over a period of time at variable interest rate, which are non-compounding with no late fees, unlike credit cards.
Well, that's made it very clear. Thanks, Darwin. Now that Affirm is going public, I'm guessing it should mean that its business is doing very well?
Yeah, so far it's growing. But the business is not profitable. In fact, it's still seeing volatilities in the revenue and operating expense growth rate. Critically, leading up to Q2 2020, it appeared that expenses growth rate outpaced revenue increase. So Affirm's business also has two significant concentration risks, however. Number one, its growth is closely tied to that of Peloton's. I mentioned before that Affirm's buy now, pay later is really a match to merchants that sells high-priced items. And Peloton sells $4,000 stationary bikes, right? So Peloton is one of the beneficiaries of the stay-at-home trend, and its revenue has increased 172% in fiscal year Q4 2020. And as of September 2020, Peloton contributed about 30% of Affirm's revenue, more than double from the same period a year ago. So if Peloton sales go down, so likely will Affirm's. Number two, the majority of Affirm's loan is originated from one bank, Cross River Bank, CRB. This partnership is non-exclusive, which means CRB can offer loans to Affirm's competitors potentially. And there's also a risk of termination of the agreement, which will significantly hamper Affirm's lending business.
Okay, then, time for a quick summary. We've talked about Starbucks and role number one, which is taking in deposits. Next, we've got Affirm and role number two, which is lending. Now, we've come to Ant Group. Unlike Starbucks and Affirm, Ant actually does all the things that a bank does. It takes in deposits, it has money market fund products, lends out money, has its own proprietary credit scoring system, and it even sells insurance.
And yet, it's not a bank. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's talk about the inception of Ant first. So Ant actually has a long history. It was established 5 years after Alibaba's emergence. It started off as Alipay, which was later renamed as Ant Financial, which then expanded into Ant Group. Alipay was first created by Jack Ma and his associates to facilitate e-commerce transactions on Alibaba's platform. At the time, one of the primary challenges of mass adoption of e-commerce in China was the lack of trust between the sellers and the buyers. So Alipay was created as an intermediary that would keep the consumer's money in escrow until the delivery by the seller was completed, after which the money would then be transferred to the seller. In a way, it is what PayPal was to eBay in the early days. And in 2014, Alipay was merged into Ant Group. So today, the company has multiple products, as you mentioned. It's used by more than 1 billion people and more than 80 million merchants, processing $17.7 trillion in total transaction volume in the 12 months ending in June 2020. In its home market, China, it has 54.4% mobile wallet market share, more than Tencent's WeChat Pay. But it also has a significant user base outside China. It has more than 300 million users via partnerships with local e-wallet providers in Southeast Asia, India, South Korea, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. It has $173 billion of assets managed in its money market fund, and it has facilitated $290 billion in consumer loans. So it's a massive undertaking, right? It has achieved this scale by actually being very aggressive in its cross-selling of its product to its users. Ant regularly makes its credit service the default payment. Even when the user has not set it as default, it automatically increases the credit limit so the user borrows more. There's a really good Financial Times article about this aggressive tactic that we will also link on the show notes. As a result of this cross-selling, 80% of its consumers use three or more of Ant's services, and about 40% use all of its five services.
You know, the more you describe Ant, the more it sounds like a bank.
Yeah, yet Ant is adamant in not being seen, let alone regulated as a bank. This past summer, Ant dropped the financial services from its name, and it even goes as far as requesting securities firms to assign technology analysts to cover the company rather than as a bank. The goal here is twofold. Number one, it's higher valuation. Larger cap tech stocks in China, even in the US, have a higher price to earning ratios, three times higher than their financial counterparts. Number two is less regulations. By being viewed as a technology company, Ant hopes to be less regulated and be less concerned about the stringent reserve requirements, especially when lending out money, and the need to get various licenses.
I suppose this is where both the company and its leadership collided with the Chinese government.
Right. Here's the sequence of events. Ant is supposed to go public in Hong Kong and Shanghai stock markets rather than in New York. This would have helped bolster international standing of these two exchanges as rivalry between China and US was heating up. IPO was very highly anticipated. It was supposed to raise about $30 billion from public investors. The anticipation alone created a frenzy. Retail investors in China, in Hong Kong, from student taxi drivers to working professionals, used up their savings, borrowed heavily to invest in the IPO, and a lot of them used leverage, borrowing from their brokers, oftentimes more than 10 times leverage. But alas, it was not meant to be. Days before the IPO, on October 24th, 2020, Jack Ma attended a financial forum in Shanghai and gave a 20-minute speech that criticized the regulating bodies for being overly focused on risk and overlooking the credit needs for the development. So there's a lot of top brass from the Communist Party and also the regulatory body that was in attendance. He also called the large Chinese banks to have pawn shop mentality, quote-unquote, and called out the lack of financial systems in China, and I quote, "There's no systemic financial risk in China because there's no financial system in China. The risks are a lack of system." So the comments went viral. President Xi Jinping was reported himself to make the call to stop Ant's IPO. So on October 31st, financial regulators drafted new regulations directed at Ant and other microlending institutions. On November 2nd, days after, Jack Ma was summoned to meet the regulators. On the same day, the draft of the new regulations was published. And on November 3rd, the IPO was halted on both exchanges.
You see, this is just a simple reminder to the Chinese companies that thou shall not incur the immense wrath of the Chinese government. That's just the plain truth.
Yes, this is the fundamental difference in doing business in the West, specifically in the US versus in a country like China. There's a rule of laws of how certain things are done to conduct business. Well, at least until recently, under Trump, that is.
Yeah, I fully agree. So what next? Ant will want an IPO at some point, but I guess it won't be very soon.
Yeah, with the new regulations, Ant will have to reorganize its business. The new rule mandates that Ant provides at least 30% of the loans it makes to its users. Right now, only 2% of the funds it lends out is still on its balance sheet. And remember, it has lent out more than $290 billion in loans. And giving out loans is its primary revenue driver. 40% of its revenue comes from lending. So with this new capital requirements, Ant's lending growth will significantly slow down and will make the business a lot more capital intensive and potentially more volatile. When Ant decides to go public again, when it's ready, it may happen in late 2021 or 2022, because it'll take time for the company to restructure to accommodate for the new rules. It will be seen and be regulated more as a bank. This means much more modest valuation. Typically, Chinese banks trade on average 4 to 10 times their earnings, while tech companies regularly trade between 30 to 50 times their earnings. And also means increased, heavier scrutiny from the regulatory body.
That was a heck of a session. Thanks, Darwin, for your analysis. These recent discussions at Airbnb, Tesla, and even Ant Group gave me a lot of insight on the complexities of the IPO process.
Yeah, thanks again, Kai. Great chatting as always. Talk to you next week.
To our listeners, we hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. For more insights into markets and emerging technologies, please visit our blog at vested.co.in. As always, take care and stay safe.